Okay. Good afternoon. So last time we talked about the page cache, which was the idea that we would have all the data our program uses and data in files. That would be something where we'd always have a location. It could be on disk, and we'd keep as much of it as we could in our physical memory as a cache. And our cache hits, we'd have our page tables for when a program is accessing some memory location, which might be part of a file or not, but the processor would look up in the page table, figure out where it is in physical memory, if it was a hit, and if we're like reading a file, the OS is going to have some data structure pointing out, here are the parts of the file I already have loaded into memory that you don't need to bother going to disk for. And on a miss, we'd have a page fault if we were having a program access something, or we just do a lookup from a system call for something like read. In either case, we look up the location on disk based on the file system for files, which we'll talk about much more later, or using some trick like let's just stash where we swap this thing to disk in the page table entry since we're not using most of its bits, and figure out how to load it back when a program needed it. Then we wanted to talk about, well, we know we're doing this cache. How do we actually manage what we keep in the cache? Sometimes we're going to run out of space, the program's going to request something, and we're going to need to get rid of something we're currently keeping in memory. And we want to choose well. And to do that, we need to predict what's the program going to do. And we want to have some model of what do programs typically do. And a general model we had was this idea of a working set, that a program has a particular set of stuff in memory it's currently using, some set of pages that are its working set, and those are the things it uses, and essentially everything else it doesn't care about. And this means that our ideal replacement policy, if we want to choose things not in any working set as pages to get rid of and get data that's actually being used, and a good way of approximating that is things that are most recently used, because those are things that are part of things that are active in current programs, and things which aren't, for the most part, are not going to be recently used. We know there's some exceptions, like when a program, you know, was doing something and is switching to acting on other data, we might have some wrong answers here, but we'll do pretty well with this. So this is the typical model we'll end up using for dealing with what data you want to keep in memory for running programs. We mentioned that it's not the only model out there. In particular, if we're not dealing with things like programs, we might have a different idea like a power law or ZIF distribution, where we say some things are just popular and some things just aren't. And you know, whether they're accessed recently, you know, it's a hint that they're popular, but it doesn't tell you that if you see something start being accessed, that's going to be accessed again if it was previously unpopular. That's not the model we have for programs. As programs, we say, if you're accessing this, we think it's part of the working set now. And with this in mind, we talked about producing our page replacement policy, and for now, we're focusing entirely on hit rate, that we want to maximize the portion of time that there are cache hits. We want to minimize the amount of time we need to bring something in on disk. And for now, we're working on the assumption that we're only going to bring things in from disk when we have to, you know, at the last possible moment. We're not going to do anything proactive. We're not going to try to do any guessing. And we mentioned our strategy for doing this practically, that we can, like, theoretically see, well, we want to do least recently used, but that means we need to keep track of every time a program accesses something, you know, in memory, and that's all the time. Like every instruction accesses its actual machine code and possibly some other things. That's a whole lot of bookkeeping to do for every single thing the program is doing. It's just not practical. So our practical answer is that we're not going to do real least recently used. We're going to do some approximation. And we can detect accesses sort of in a time window by saying, okay, we're going to temporarily make a page table entry invalid, or we're going to use this access bit, which is just going to be yes or no, and figure out if during some time window the program tried to access the data. And given that, we can find stuff which is not recently used, which is what we really care about. We don't care about getting the least recently used thing as much as making sure we're not in the top more recently used stuff. So any questions about this talk from last time? Okay, so before I move on, let's talk about the paging homework. So the paging homework has two parts, and paging test tests both parts of the homework. And this apparently has confused some people. So if you've only implemented the first part, yes, I do not expect paging test to like actually just work. And in particular, some of the copy on write tests, because they're testing copy on write, are designed to run out of memory if there's no copy on write. And some of them will hang if they run out of memory, just because they don't handle fork failing as well as they could, which is probably a bug, sorry. So if it fails for this part, after printing fork fail, that's okay. This is for allocate on demand. It's not okay for the second part, obviously. If it kernel panics, that is not okay. Like, there should not be a normal user program I can write where you kernel panic. So that's never okay, even though the test is not testing. You know, it's testing copy on write. And I understand, sorry that this confused people, probably should have been clearer in the assignment about what things were tested. Okay, so questions on homework issues like this? Yes. What is a guard page? So when we talked about the XV6 memory layout, we mentioned that there's a page below the stack, which is where you would keep going if you push stuff onto the stack until you ran out of space. And the idea of this is that when we go beyond the end of the stack, we enter this guard page, and the guard page is marked as not user accessible by the XV6 kernel, meaning it will trigger a page fault. So you'll get an error when you go over the end of the stack rather than overwriting something in your code, which would be really confusing. And this is a typical thing operating systems do. Other questions? Yeah.
Above the heap, there's like any valid space. Is that just not present? Is that how we know that we're in that invalid space?
So the question is, how do we know we're in the space that's above the heap? So in stock XV6, it's just NARC is not present. But that's not going to help you so much when you implement allocate on demand, because of course there'll be parts that are legitimately parts of the heap which are marked as not present. But you're tracking where the end of the heap is, and that will tell you if you're in that space or not. Okay, yeah.
Is there a difference between walk page directory returning 0 and it returning page table entry with the present bit of 0?
Question is that there are differences between walk page store returning 0 or returning a page table entry that's not present, and yes. So if it returns 0, that means that there was no first level page table entry. No present first level page table entry for it. And most importantly, like if you're trying to use this to allocate a page, you can't use the pointer 0 to set a page table entry. Whereas if you've got a not present page, you could modify it with the pointer. As far as what it means for whether the page, you know, page exists in the page table, it's the same, right? It's not if the processor tries to access it, it's a page fault. Other questions? Okay. So we're going to pick up where we left last time with our one simple sort of practical version of LRU, which was our second chance algorithm. Remember, the idea was we have this ordered list of pages, and we keep track of whether things have been accessed while they've been on the list using one of those two methods I talked about, either this access bit the processor helps us with, or by setting them invalid until they're accessed, and then recording, yeah, they were accessed. And if something goes to the end of the list, we check, well, was it referenced? If so, we reset that reference bit, put it at the top of the list, because we know it was accessed kind of recently, and we keep taking from the list until we get something where the reference bit wasn't set. So here's, yeah, and we call this second chance because we're giving a page a second chance if it's been accessed while on the list. And so here's an example of what might happen with it. And I'm showing here the list in order, last added at the top, the end of the list, the next thing you want to allocate at the bottom. And note that when I access A, it comes referenced, so that's the R, and everything else was not referenced. So we access B, it becomes referenced. We access C, it becomes referenced, and also allocated. So we allocated 2 here because it was at the end of the list and not referenced, so it got allocated. We allocated 3 here, so it's the end of the list and not referenced, so that's where we put C. Then we access D, and we need to do a bunch of manipulations of the list. We look at 1, and we say, well, it was referenced. I'm going to give it a second chance. I'm going to put it at the top of the list as not referenced. We look at 2. I'm going to put it at the top of the list as not referenced. We're giving it a second chance. We look at 3. We give it a second chance, and, well, page 1's, you know, physical page 1's second chance was very unproductive because it got all the way to the bottom of the list as not referenced, so we end up allocating D in that slot. Then here we access B, and we look at the bottom of our list, and page 2 is sitting there. It hasn't been referenced, so it's going to become referenced. Sorry, B, we access B, which is in page 2, and it becomes referenced because it's there. All right, just use 2. Then we access A, which was replaced by D, remember, so it's not in here. So we need to allocate it. So we look at the bottom, we say, okay, page 3, is it referenced? Nope, so we're not going to give it a second chance. We're just going to allocate A in that slot, replacing C. Then we have access C, which we just replaced because I'm trying to illustrate what's happening. We look at 1 at the bottom here. We see it's referenced. We're going to give it a second chance, and that's, you know, kind of reasonable. And then we look at 2. We find out it hasn't been referenced, so we're going to replace B with C. Yes? Here? Why doesn't it move up to the top? So the question is, why don't we reorder the list based on when things are referenced? So this policy is built assuming that we're using something like that hardware support we talked about, where there's this access bit we have to explicitly check. And so because of that, we just record that it's referenced while it's going through this list, and we don't actually investigate that bit until it gets all the way to the bottom. So we aren't actually, so even though, you know, we could have detected immediately when this reference change happened and decided, well, we probably want it near the last added part of the list so it doesn't get used for soon, that's not what this policy does. This policy says, I want to do the minimum page fault handling whatsoever and not do that. So this is a policy choice we made. And you're right that it seems like it would be a good idea to, when this happens here, that 2 probably should move to the top of the list. But that's not something we do. And in a real OS, the compromise would be that we're avoiding having a page fault in that case by just having the processor set a bit in our page table for us.
Can you reiterate what happens right after that step?
So when we access A, so we're trying to access A. The processor looks for it here. It's not going to be in our page table, so it's a page fault. And as part of the page fault handler, we're going to look at 2 as the end of the list and say, can I allocate A in 2? And we're going to say, no, it's referenced, so it moves to the top of the list. Then we're going to look at 3, say, can I allocate A in 3? And we're going to say, yep, I can. We're going to allocate A there. It's going to immediately be used, so it's referenced. Okay, other questions? Okay, so this is a particular policy that is relatively simple to implement. And it has some disadvantages. So, like, one thing you'll notice is that we have things go all the way through the list in order to get used. And with three pages, well, that's kind of fine. If we have, like, 10,000, we actually kind of want to avoid that. And the information about when things are referenced, like, things can be, with it, like, if we had 1,000 pages, things could be referenced quite a while ago, and we'd still be saying, nope, 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 reference too soon. We don't want to, like, detect over a smaller time window whether things were actually used. So here's a variation of this policy called seek, which uses two lists instead of one. And we're going to do the thing you wanted to do, which is say, well, when something's referenced, we should move it right away to the top of our don't use this list. So we're going to have two lists of pages. We're going to have an active list, and these are things we think are being used, or guessing are being used. And we're going to have in an active list, which is the things we're guessing are not being used. And we're going to do something similar to the second chance policy with the inactive list. What we're going to say is, we're going to assume things on the inactive list probably aren't going to be used, but if they are, if they're referenced before they make it all the way through the list, we're going to take them and put them right at the top of the active list because now we know, nope, nope, we were wrong. They're used. Let's not try to use them soon. So we'll start new pages at the top of the active list, and we'll also end up putting pages where we discover exactly when they're referenced at the top of the active list. And when a page has been on the active list for a long while without us checking on it, we'll experimentally move it to the inactive list, guessing that maybe it's not really being used anymore. And so we're going to just guess it's old, it's been around a while, maybe it's inactive. We might be wrong, but that's going to be our guess. And if our guess is wrong, well, we'll find out not too long from now that it's part of a working set, and so it's going to be used. And when that happens, we'll detect that like as a page fault, or we'll periodically scan the reference bits, but we'll somehow detect that and we'll move it over to the active list, saying, nope, we were wrong, let's just wait another long while before we start trying to use this page. And if it makes it all the way through the inactive list without experiencing any sorts of accesses that we detect, we know it's not referenced recently, and we just use it as something to replace. Yes?
So the size of the inactive list determines how far back in the past you're looking, whether or not it's referenced.
Yeah, so you said the size of the active list determines how far back we look. Exactly. So this is a parameter we have to choose, and it determines how sensitive we are to the past. So if it's too small, like we won't detect enough accesses far back. If it's too large, we're just, you know, going to be spending too much time moving things through lists and, like, worrying about things that happened a long time ago where the program has changed its behavior since then. So, and this is what Linux does, and Linux has to make a choice about how big is the inactive list, and they make some arbitrary choice, like a quarter of memory or something like that. Yes?
So, just to confirm, like, things are moved from the active unconditionally?
Yes, so things are moved from the inactive list to...
From the active list, just whenever they get to the bottom.
Yes, so with what I'm showing here, I'm not sure if that's like exactly what Linux does, but that the general idea is that, yeah, things unconditionally make it from the active to an active list, where the usual justification is that you'll try to make sure the inactive list has a certain size. Yeah. Can something on the active list go back to the top of the active list? Not with what I'm showing here. You could imagine that would be a reasonable variation of this policy, but it's not something I have in this picture. But it's certainly like a reasonable idea. You can do like more and more complicated things, which might be better and better at the cost of, well, now you're doing more work on like page faults and so on. Other questions? Okay. And you can consider this type of policy as sort of a, there's a general family of policies, many of which you're suggesting, of like, you know, we can move things on these lists more often. You can say, well, we have like two lists here, why don't we have three? You know, move from, you know, active, less active, inactive, you know, we could have three lists and move between them and get from the last one. And there's a, just a general set of policies known as sort of clock algorithms, which, where we have a list of pages and periodically we scan whether they were referenced and their time on the list. And this is similar to what that's doing. So there's a whole family of policies you can imagine of this kind of form, where we basically periodically are scanning to see if things are accessed, and we have a history of some sort of accesses. So that the seek policy isn't really that, but it's in the same family that we, you know, we're getting, we have more more precise historical information than second chance. And sort of the generalization of that is that we can just like keep a history of, was it referenced in some time window? And this is a way of doing that, is that you just have a list and you have like an actual history and you make your decision based on, if it's not referenced some number of times, I'm going to use it. And this is often called a clock algorithm. And it's so called because a popular representation of it is with the hands of a clock, that we have our physical pages and we're scanning to set this, what's the last reference bit, and adding to this list of, was it referenced since our last scan? So this is another sort of more general version of this, I want to keep track of history some way algorithm, which is more explicit about the history. So rather than sort of kind of implicitly doing it by having separate list of pages, we're just saying we could just explicitly like track accesses over some time window and say, was it not accessed in X time windows? And use this information to make a decision in all sorts of ways. We could say, if it's not accessed the last two times, we do something, or we could do something more complicated than that. So this is sort of the general form of this, and there's all sorts of variations which all have this flavor of periodically check for accesses and see if it hasn't been accessed enough for some definition of enough based on the last reference information. So any questions about this general idea? So this is, so these sorts of more sophisticated variations of LRU are typically what you see real OS is using, and not much more sophisticated, because as I said, this is what Linux is doing. You know, it's, this is good enough. Linux doesn't find it worthwhile to do something more complicated. That is for non-file pages. We'll talk about something Linux does for file pages, which is a bit more complicated, but it's actually doing something which is less good at approximating LRU, and we'll talk about why later. So let's talk about some issues which are orthogonal to this. So we've talked about how do we choose what page to replace, but we kind of skipped over, like, when are we doing these changes? And the policy here is that I'm taking pages from the bottom of this list only when I need them. So if my program suddenly tries to access a gigabyte of memory, I'm going to just take pages from this really, really fast. And if I'm not doing much, I'm going to take pages really, really slow. Well, that's kind of nice in the sense that we're kind of adapting how much work we do based on what's happening. But we might want to do a bit better. So most real OSs don't like actually waiting until we actually need the memory to start doing that eviction process. And there's two big issues with this. So one issue has to do with things that are parts of files and are dirty. So if I write to a file, I want that write to just write to the cache. That's the fast thing to do. But given that, how much data can I lose if my computer loses power? Given that, you know, our replacement policy. So with that policy, I write to a file, in my text editor, close my text editor, do nothing with my machine, what's going to happen? Yeah.
The size of the cache.
So I can have the size of the cache of data lost. And as long as I'm not doing anything, it's like I write a file in my text editor, the text editor calls the write system call, it writes to the cache. And why would we want to write anywhere else? That would be a waste of time. We're not going to get rid of something from the cache unless I start doing something with my machine. So like I keep my machine running, and like 5 days later it loses power. I open up that text file and it's not there. Like that's what would happen. And that's not acceptable. So people have said, yeah, I don't want it to be the case that I can lose an unbounded amount of data just because you haven't actually gotten rid of something from the cache and written it back to files on disk. Especially if we have lots of memory, so you're actually keeping all my files in memory all the time. So one thing that real OSs do is that they generally have some policy where they're going to periodically scan, ignoring when they have to actually replace things and write them back to disk, and write things back in advance. And this is primarily to avoid data loss. It's also helpful for performance in that you can do this while other things are running, and when something needs memory, now you have to do less work to give it more memory. Because if you want to reallocate something you have cached to a file that needed to be written back, well, you already wrote it, you don't need to do that work before the program can keep running. But the most important reason to do it is that you would be really disappointed if you could lose like a day of work by losing power in your machine. So the other thing with respect to performance that operating systems do is that we have this idea that, we allocate memory by evicting pages and pages that haven't been used in a long time, so it's okay. But we're only doing this when we need to allocate memory. Otherwise, why would we get rid of something from our cache? But this is not so great for performance in that it means that whenever our program starts using memory, we need to do the work of going through all the page tables that might point to that page, doing that reverse lookup. And remember when I showed you the data structures in Linux, that reverse lookup's pretty complicated. We have a whole bunch of lists to check and need to modify all the page table entries. So there's an alternative that most OSs do, and that's they'll do some work in the background to evict pages in advance. They'll try to keep a little bit of memory free so they don't have to do any work, at least for a little bit of memory allocation. This won't always work out because you could allocate memory and start using it faster than it can, free pages, and you might have to wait. But this means in the common case, it will already have freed some stuff up, so when you start a program, it can just give that program new pages right away without doing any modifications of page tables or file cache data structures or so on. It just has a bunch of free pages already available. And this means that allocation can be really simple, can just be removed from this list of already evicted pages. As long as that list doesn't end up draining all the way, it's really fast. And so for the common case, it can be. And when you're evicting pages, well, you can do that probably at times when the CPU is not fully utilized anyway, so it's kind of free. Okay. Some questions about this idea? Yeah. This free part? Yeah, so when I say it's evicting earlier in the background is free, I mean, if I think about my desktop system, there's a lot of times when I'm not using much CPU, when I'm not actively typing or web browsing or something, and the OS can just use some of those cycles, so when I actually do something, it's faster. So in many cases, sort of it's, we're not actually compromising user visible performance by doing this. Even though it does take some time to evict things, and we might never use the things we've evicted. Okay, so that's about some notions of things that we can do which are a little better than the naive policy of only act when we actually need to allocate pages. So far the policies we've talked about have been about LRU. Now, LRU isn't always great. Can someone tell me some cases where LRU is a bad idea? Where this idea, where we want to do things with the least recently used pages, those are the ones we want to replace with other stuff. Where's that assumption work out not in our favor? Yeah.
Cycling through a list that's slightly larger than the cache.
Okay. Cycle through large than RAM list. So yeah, so I'm cycling through some larger than RAM list. That's not going to be good because we're going to try to keep the stuff that I cycled through most recently, which is precisely not what I'm going to, when the stuff I cycled through least recently is what I'm going to access next. Some other things that might be problematic? Yeah.
And the access order is not like necessarily linear. Like you could be accessing different things at different times, and then maybe the least recently used thing is something that you could need to use next.
Okay. That's actually, so the question is like the access order is not linear. Maybe the, so this is like random access?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other things? Okay, so there's one case I can think of, which is not actually complicated, that where LRU is bad, which is reading a file once. There's no reuse, but when, as you're reading it, it's going to be most recently used, you're going to try to cache it. Okay. So the scanning patterns you mentioned of cycling through something once and doing it and reading a file once are two things that Linux was concerned about. So we're going to talk about an algorithm for doing that. For random access, it's a good question of what you should do. And one thing you might imagine doing, which I think like Linux supports, is that you could tell the OS you're doing this and it will not cache things. That would be an example of a policy for that. We're going to talk about a policy Linux does transparently without the program telling it what it's doing, because it's worried about this idea of cycling through some larger than RAM file. So one example is I have like a 100 gigabyte file, I read the whole file again, or I'm reading files once. Like I'm processing, converting one file to another, or I'm like playing a movie. I don't actually care about keeping the whole movie in my cache because I'm probably not gonna read it over and over again, even though I just accessed it, and making that more efficient. So Linux tries to handle this sort of scanning pattern. And the heuristic they use for this is something where they're going to not do the LRU thing precisely with the hope of handling something like I'm playing a video. And that's, we're not going to consider pages active until they're accessed the second time. So we're first going to guess, you're only reading this thing once. And only if we see it accessed a second time while it's still in the cache are we going to say, yep, it's really something I'm supposed to cache. So we're going to guess for stuff in the files that probably is just a single read until you confirm otherwise that it's not. And this is a heuristic. It could be wrong some of the times. But it's going to handle our read once patterns. And it's also going to handle where we cycle through a file, because by the time we cycle to the, cycle around, if it doesn't fit in memory, it will have gotten out of the cache. It won't have been read more than once. And the big motivation for this is that without this change, Linux had problems where a program that was reading a large file would just slow down everything else in the machine, because Linux would try really hard to keep that large file in cache and make the stuff the other programs were accessing not be in the cache. sort of get this false signal that, oh, this program that's reading this file once needs lots and lots of memory to be fast, even though that wasn't true. So this is what that algorithm looks like. And it's implemented sort of on top of the existing sort of active inactive list seek algorithm. So the idea is that rather than saying that stuff from files starts as active, we're not going to guess that. We're going to guess if it's something from a file, I'm going to assume that it's inactive. You're not going to use it for very long. So I'm going to put it on the top of the inactive list. And if something on the inactive list is referenced once, I'm going to assume, well, that's just a fluke. You accessed it once. I don't need to actually deal with it. Only if it's accessed twice am I going to move it back to the active list. And otherwise, we're going to work like we did before. Something that's, if something's not referenced, well, similar to the second chance policy. So if something's not referenced when it's at the bottom of the active list, we're going to guess it's inactive and try to see if it's accessed more than once to confirm otherwise. And if something gets to the bottom of the active list and is referenced, we're going to move it to the top of the active list. We're going to assume that it's not inactive in this case. And this is just to detect single scans of files. It's the main purpose of this. So the idea is that on the inactive list, just scanning over a file data once isn't enough to make something become active. And we have this protection of checking if it's referenced, I assume, to make sure that if you're actually using something, we don't even try to guess that it might be inactive. Because we might miss some cases because we're checking for two references. But the key idea is that we guess the file pages will be used once and then can be discarded, and we wait for our guess to be confirmed. And once it is active, we make sure, because we're doing this if reference thing, make it active again, we're going to keep it active if it's still being referenced. Yes?
So that loop back to the top of the active list from the active list?
Yeah.
What if that thing is like a super large file, or something you just want to...
So the question is, if this is a super large file and it loops back to the top, is that bad? Yeah. And I think the mitigation for that is, the hope is that if it's a super large file, either it's going to be take long, we're going to have enough accesses that something's going to make it through the active list twice, or it's going to be inactive and get out of the cache and end up going through this new file pages route to the inactive list, is the hope. But this is all heuristics. So a common thing you'll see in all these heuristics is there are always ways you can kind of out-clever the heuristics and make something bad happen. And that's exactly sort of something where you could imagine, maybe like if the sizes are exactly right, we might have this sort of false positive from that reference check. Yeah?
So in this case, when you add a new file page, it would already be like considered referenced, and then it would have to be referenced again to be evicted, right?
So the question is, when we add a new file page, it's already considered referenced. So far, we've only talked about bringing things into the cache when they're actually accessed. As we'll learn, this is not the only reason things will be brought into the cache. We'll talk about that next.
I guess I'm just thinking, isn't this a lot more work to add in the other loop on the active list, when you could just say that things haven't been referenced yet when they're new, and then just check in the inactive list? Now we're adding and checking in two different places, which seems like a lot of work.
You're saying it seems like a bunch of work. So the work of checking, because we have to do this check here anyways, is do some investigation here. It's not too much, it's an if statement. But yes, it is more work. Especially this is more work to implement. We need to have a counter now. But they felt it was worth it, and the reason they felt it was worth it is because the cost of having the wrong policy are much higher. If you remember, the cost of reading from disk is milliseconds. So if we think that this is typically saving us, you know, a couple milliseconds for every second, well, we can spend a lot of time actually implementing our policy, and it's okay. Yeah?
If something's, like, in a list, doesn't that mean it's in a cache, or, like, how is the...
So the question is, something's in one of these lists, is it cached? And the answer is yes. So everything in the active and inactive list are cached pages.
So I thought we weren't, like, caching if we're using it once.
So the question is, why are we caching it at all if we're using it once? So to access the file, we do need to bring it into the cache, because that's the only place where read or write are going to work with, and the only way, if the program mmaps it, where we're going to be able to let the program access it. So even though we're only accessing it once, the only mechanism we're going to have to access files is bringing it into the cache. Yes?
So then how is it, like, a lower level of cache or something? How is it inactive to active?
So the inactive to active, the question is, this multiple levels of cache? So this is one level of cache, because it's the same time to access it from the program, because it's in your page table, or it isn't. And if it's in your page table, it's on one of these lists. This is just a way of managing the order of things in that cache.
So it's super minor differences.
So from a program's perspective, the difference is just in how long when we evict your things from the cache. So this is all just about deciding, when do we evict things from the cache? So we have, if you vaguely remember, if you at least took 30 through 30, and I assume other courses we talked about caches, we talked about replacement policies and caches. Like for the set, this is this implementing a replacement policy for our cache.
It's all about, like, the bottom of the inactive list.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what makes it there? The question is just about figuring out what makes it to the bottom of the inactive list. That's the important decision. Yes.
Okay, yeah. So in that case we're reading, like, one really huge file, we still have to, like, put it all in the cache, but it just gets evicted really quickly?
So the question is, if we're reading one really huge file, we still put it in the cache and it gets evicted quickly? Yes. So that huge file, as we read it, we're gonna put its pages on the inactive list, and they're gonna relatively quickly make their way to the bottom of the inactive list, and we'll get rid of them. Yeah.
In this diagram, if we send something to the active list, are we also making it not referenced?
So the question is, if we send something to the active list, are we also making it not referenced? I assume so. I'm not actually entirely precisely sure on exactly how Linux does its reference scanning, because that code is surprisingly annoying to read because it works in every architecture. So there's lots of indirection. Other questions? So this gives us this, as I said, is the algorithm for file pages. So Linux, this is the picture from the documentation by the people who wrote the Linux memory management code, revised the Linux memory management code kind of recently. So we have our algorithm for file pages, where we have our active list, which moves to the inactive list, and on two references, it moves back to the active list. That's what they're showing here. And if something makes it to the bottom, being referenced not never or once, it gets used. And we have the algorithm for non-file pages, which was the seek algorithm I showed earlier. We have the active list. Things from the active list go to the inactive list. And if they're referenced, they end up on the top of the active list. And there's a few other things they're showing here. One is, I mentioned that we evict things proactively, so Linux does that. That's what this page out is, and they have this list of recently evicted pages. And they have this thing labeled refault, so Linux does this thing where it'll evict a page, and if it discovers in the small time window after it evicts it that, oops, it made a mistake, it will, and the data's still in the page, it will reuse it. If it hasn't cleared the page, it can put it back in the page tables, which is still faster than reading it from disk. And we also have this category of non-reclaimable pages, which is you can request that, hey, I have this memory I want my program to have, and don't put it on disk ever, please. keep it in memory, and that's what that is. Okay, so that's Linux page replacement as just an example of what a real OS would do. There's lots of variations, which are usually like how many lists you have, you know, when do you, what, how many references do you need, but this is this general sort of thing you'll see all OS is doing with these heuristics about usually guessing what the sort of access patterns they care about are. And you see Linux cares about working set type things and these dealing with scans of files. Okay, yeah.
So
the question, is this what XP6 does? No. XP6 doesn't implement a page cache. XP6 has just said, when I allocate something to the program, I never write it to disk. When I read from disk, I, you know, doesn't implement a page cache. So it does the much simpler thing, but it's slower because it doesn't cache anything. So, you know.
But it still has to write back pages when you run out of memory, but that's a different mechanism.
So the question is, XP6 still have to write back pages when you run out of memory? So when you run out of memory in XP6, in the stock version, your system call fails. Like, if you ask for more memory with sbreak, it just fails. In the assignment for allocate on demand, we tell you if you run out of memory and for copy and write, that if you run out of memory, we want you to kill the program. So that's our solution to that problem. That we don't want you to write things to disk for the assignment. We just say, if you run out of memory, don't bother doing page replacement. Just kill the program that's trying to use memory. And obviously, that might be an OK solution for the assignment, but not for real OS. Yeah?
So XV6 can't write anything.
So XV6, what, it can't write anything to memory?
It can't write anything to the disk.
So the question is, how does XV6 write things to the disk? I'm not actually sure the details of how its I/O code works, but I think it basically writes things immediately. So like it allocates a little buffer when you do the write system call, rather than having a cache. And that's obviously a lot slower, but it's simpler to implement. I think they might have a small, like fixed size cache of recently read things from disk, but I haven't actually looked at that code much. But like it's a static memory allocation if they have one. Or something similar to that. So, other questions? Okay. Yeah. So XV6 just avoids this issue by just saying we're not going to use memory as a cache, basically. Just think programs have memory, and when you allocate them memory, it's only memory, it's not disk space. When you do read or write, the read or write allocates some buffer space to do the read or the write. And then pretty, you know, and after it's done, it's going to probably deallocate that. And if it can't allocate the space, it's just going to say, sorry, it failed. Okay, so there's one other assumption I'd like to relax, which is loading on demand. So far, when we've brought stuff in from files, it's only been because you tried to access it. And we can do better. I assert. We're going to have a way of doing better than saying, you know, why wait till the page fault? And here's an intuition of why. So let's say a program accesses page 4 of a file, then page 5, then page 6. What's the program going to access next? Just give me a guess. Like, you're not guaranteed to be right. Maybe the program just, you know, skips to the end. But what probably is going to happen, what's a reasonable assumption, is that probably it's going to access page 7 next. Like, not guaranteed, but probably it's going to access page 7. And something operating systems can do is they can just guess that. They can say, oh, I saw you access 4, 5, and 6. You're probably going to access 7. Why don't I just read that for you in advance? Even though you haven't requested it, you know, you haven't even tried to access it yet, it's a good guess you're going to want it. And I can save some time by reading it while you're doing something else. And this notion is called read ahead, and this is something that most modern OSs try to do. So let's say I want to do read ahead. How should I do it? So some question is, how do I detect the pattern? Like, where can I figure out what the pattern access pattern is? How do I detect that 4, 5, 6 pattern? Like, what's the mechanism? So what's going to happen when the program tries to like access the file? Yeah. So yeah, a page fault. Fault. You know, what the page fault's going to tell me where, or maybe a like read syscall. So how do I detect the pattern? I record where the page faults are or what part of the file reads are trying to read. Okay. So when should I start reads? And this is, you know. So what's a policy that would be reasonable for deciding when do I start doing this read ahead bit? There's all sorts of options. Many correct answers. Okay, so this is like, if I page fault on page X means read page X and X plus 1, just always?
If what's called read text or read.
Okay. X plus 1. Okay. So access page X and X, okay?
Yeah, I was trying to get, if you have like a page fault or a read, you can like look at the previous launch, and if there's some certain number that are all in order, then you would start reading.
Okay, so if I see X, X plus 1, X plus K, then read X plus K, you know, N plus 1. Okay. So let's talk about the simplest policy we had here. So you're saying that I'm going to have my file with a bunch of pages. I'm going to, you know, program reads page 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And now we've detected the pattern, and you're going to say, when the program reads 5, I want you to read ahead page 6. Okay? So then what's the program going to do? Yeah. So it's going to read page 7. So you're skipping ahead. But important thing is that the program is going to access page 6. Without a page fault. Because we're going to read it in advance, ideally. So that's your assumption, that assuming we read it in, we put it in this page table, it's going to access it without a page fault. So the next thing we're going to see is page 7. So this is a bit of a subtlety with doing this read ahead, which is that if I read ahead and fill in the pages for it, I don't actually see them as accesses anymore. So there are two solutions to that. And one solution is going to be that, OK, we still actually want to detect accesses to things we write ahead. Yeah?
You can assume that it's not going to read every other page and just, if the last one was 5, say, do I was right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Or could you like say, instead of like directly loading X and X plus 1 at the same time, could you like read X and then have a page fault?
Yeah, so one solution to this would be to say we read X and X plus 1, but don't put X plus 1 in the page table. And that means we'll have a page fault, but it's already going to be there, so it's going to be a fast page fault. So that might be okay. That would be one solution to this. But it's a subtlety here that we, you know, if we fill it in, we don't get to know about future reads. Okay. So this gives us an idea of what read-ahead looks like. And what Linux does for read-ahead is remarkably similar to what you described here. I'll talk about that a bit. So there's another question here. How much do we read ahead? Any ideas? Like, how much should we read ahead? Like, how should we determine that?
Well,
Yeah.
And could we continue to use history to try and determine, like, if we've already read 3 pages, maybe we're going to read 3 more or something like that?
Okay. So, you know, so history, so you're saying the amount already read? Okay. Any other ideas? So what's the goal in choosing how much we, what's the disadvantage of reading ahead too much? Someone who hasn't talked, yeah, back there. Yeah, so if we read ahead too much, then we're putting a bunch of stuff in cache which might never be used. And even in the case where it is used, even in the case where the program doesn't stop, if we get way ahead of the program, we're still evicting a bunch of stuff from the cache now, even though the program can't use it very soon. Okay. And so we have this sort of compromise that if we read ahead too much, we're going to get rid of stuff from the cache, and it might not be worth it. We might just be wasting time. If we read ahead too little, the program's going to catch up with us, and it's going to have to wait again. So our goal in how much to read ahead is going to be to try to beat the program. You know, try to be faster than the program, but not by much. Yeah, but not too much, by much. Yeah.
Explain how the program catches up in like one of these cases that we were talking about.
So the question is how the program catches up. So when we read x and x plus 1, that's going to take a certain amount of time. So it might be the case that we don't manage to read x plus 1 by the time the program needs it, even though we're reading it ahead. Like we're faster than we would be otherwise, faster than if we waited for the program to request x plus 1, but the program's still waiting because we aren't reading far enough ahead for how fast our disk is.
Then would reading farther ahead also take more time?
So the question is, would read farther ahead take more time? So when we talk about how disks work, we'll learn that disks don't quite, well, I guess there's disks are probably fast in for reading sequential things. So there's another motivation for this. So it's actually going to be a lot faster to read a bunch of stuff. You know, we can do that pretty fast, but starting that read takes a while. And we'll talk about that more when we talk about file systems. Okay. So I'll go through what Linux does. So the Linux, you know, has this tough question of how much to read ahead. So they have heuristics, and these are heuristics, like what you all suggested. They're guesses. They have some good reasoning behind them. And the Linux heuristics is to work based on how much was read ahead before, but they don't count the number total. They count the number that are still cached. So the idea is that if we're tight on memory, this is lower because we've evicted that stuff, especially since we have this policy of trying to look for scans. So we count the number that are cached, and guess we should read about that many more. That's the heuristic. And by counting the number with your cache, this way, if we're tight on memory, we're going to read ahead less and disrupt other programs less. And if we're not, we're going to read ahead more. And also, if the application's using the file more of the pages it's accessing are going to be cached, hopefully. So we'll read ahead more aggressively in that case, and less aggressively if it's not using the file very quickly. And Linux needs to keep track of where to read ahead. So what Linux does is it reads ahead a bunch of pages, and it chooses a point in the middle of those pages. This is ASCII art from the Linux documentation that it marks as where I want to detect write reads. And when the program reads from that, then it reads ahead the next set of stuff. So the idea is that it reads ahead this amount and waits for the program to access this far into it before it reads ahead another chunk of that size. So it tries to keep size bytes ahead of where the program is, checking, you know, these periodically to see if the program's still reading the file. And this is how it deals with the issue you mentioned of Maybe the program stops at sequential reads. Maybe it's done. Maybe I pause the movie. This is an example of a memory rehead. So the heuristics can vary, but you know, this is a very important thing for performance, you know, that we can do better than just this page replacement by figuring out what programs will do. And we want to try to be careful. Like, the big goal in these heuristics for Linux is that if Linux read ahead too much, it would just start bringing things into memory that would never be used and make all your programs run slower by giving them less memory for the stuff they're actually using. So any questions on read ahead? Okay, so one last topic, I guess two last topics briefly on paging. So one is, what happens if there's not enough space? So there's a term for this called thrashing. Because what typically happens is there's not enough space, we have our working set, all our programs are trying to use some amount of space, some part of each program's working set ends up being on disk, and it has to be brought in from disk, replacing something else the program is using. Then that program shortly thereafter tries to use that. That has to be brought in from disk. And we end up spending all of our time waiting to read things from disk. And this is known as thrashing. And this is what happens when you run out of memory for the working sets of programs. And you know, typically, this is just a thing we talk about. It happens. If you want to deal with it with operating systems, you need to do something where you say, sometimes I'm not going to run your program. Because that's the solution to this, is if I don't have enough space for all the stuff the programs need, I better get rid of some programs to fix it. Or else, you know, the only other option is run the programs really slow, at least one of them. Okay. And finally, a brief aside on a completely different goals for page replacement. So far, we've been talking about performance, performance, performance. And I'd like to talk about fair page replacement. That I'm not so much concerned about, you know, maximizing the performance of my system. I want to share between users. I have a server that's used by hundreds of users. I want them all to have their fair share of the memory of the system. I don't want someone using all the memory to make everyone else run really slow. I want to give them an equal part of the memory. I want to choose what pages I get rid of to do that, even though I'm caching files and things like that. I want to somehow figure out how to cache files, you know, in a way which gives everyone an equal part of the cache. And this is pretty tricky. So here, let's say we have these five processes all being run by, say, different users. I want to share fairly between them. So one question is, is everyone getting their fair share? Or is someone getting more than their fair share based on these numbers here? Any ideas on that? So who would you say is making the least use of memory? Which process or processes? Any volunteers? Yeah.
Like D&E.
D&E. So why do you say D&E?
Because almost everything is shared.
Okay, so you're saying D&E. Well, everything's shared. You know, it's not really theirs. Okay, any other ideas? Does anyone have an argument against D&E not using least? Yeah. So yeah, saying combined, they're still using more. And there's another argument I could make, which is that it's copy on write. So if either of them write to it, suddenly they'll both be using a lot more if they like start writing to that heap. Yeah, so they kind of sort of stealth reserved more memory. Okay. And you can come up with other questions, like, is this shared file count for less than this one, or doesn't it? What if process A goes away? Does process B change? So this is actually a surprisingly difficult problem because we have stuff shared between programs and because we have these cached files where, you know, maybe the program doesn't really need the 32 megabyte file cache, but it just happens to be cached. So it's not obvious how to account for memory usage on a program-by-program basis because of these shared pages and because of these cached things which may or may not be used. So Linux does have a mechanism for trying to account for the memory a particular user used and try to share that memory freely, called cgroups. And it needs a way to account for these shared pages, and it has an arbitrary choice they made, which is a policy known as last touch. So they look at who last is known to have referenced the page, known to have accessed the page, and they just assign it to that user and hope that works out. And this isn't perfect, but it's easy to implement and gets you okay results. Okay. And based on this, Linux tries to implement limits. And limits are a tricky thing. Like, what does it mean if I want to limit your memory usage when what I'm really doing is page replacement? So, and we still want to try to do least recently used stuff. We don't want to like evict stuff that's more recently used too aggressively. And the way Linux does this is that you group the processes together and you set a memory limit for the group. And the limits sort of, there are two types of limits. So there's a high limit, which it says, never let the group use more than this, meaning that if the group needs, the programs in that group need more memory and they're above their high limit, you replace their pages when you need to allocate memory rather than other program groups, even if they're, you know, by the least recently used policy, less favorable. And there's a low limit where you say, okay, the program should have at least this much memory, even if it's like cached files or something. So if it's assigned to that group of programs, don't take the pages away, even if they're not recently used. Just don't steal them if they're below that low limit. And this is the idea, is that this can help share between users. And the idea is that you can separate the processes into the groups. So you have a whole bunch of things running in each group, like maybe your website has a certain amount of memory it's allowed to use, and your login for some user has a certain amount of memory it's allowed to use. And you set those limits on each of the groups, where you have our low limit, where you say you're guaranteed at least this much, even if you're not really using it. And you have your high limit, where you say, I'm going to start taking away your pages if I need memory. And Linux also has a max, which is, if you go above that, I'm going to deallocate your pages, even if no one needs the memory. Yeah. The main point of the max is, I think the biggest issue is you want to provide consistent behavior. So people, if you're sharing a system between users, so one of those users doesn't think, oh, I can use 10 gigabytes of memory. I've done it all the time. Why did my program break? You can make sure their program always breaks if they try to do that. I think that's probably the main motivation. Yeah.
Can they also set limits on the number of groups? Because if every group was using the low limit, you would run out of...
So the question is, they also set limits on the number of groups. So this is something configured by the system administrator, and the system administrator is responsible for figuring out how to set these limits and making sure that makes sense. Okay, so that's my last like alternate thing you can do with memory. There's this fair allocation, or fair, like at least dividing memory between users. This is about the best I know of being done in the real world. Okay, so we talked about our page cache. So any questions about paging in general? I have my summary, which I just won't read before we move on. Okay, so we talked a bunch about caching things from files, and now the next topic is going to be about, well, I/O. How do we actually read the contents of those files? So we're going to talk about devices. And you may remember when we talked about earlier in the semester about kernel buffering, we mentioned that the operating system has these device drivers which have their own buffers of what's happening with the device. And when you do reads and writes, they actually communicate with those buffers. And you know, when you do a write, it puts in that buffer and actually goes to the file or the network or the disk when it's ready. And we had this layering which made this happen. So we have our standard library sort of calls, which have these system calls, but underneath there was this file interface which had these its own buffers in addition to the ones, and then we talked to the device. So we're going to start talking about how the device driver layer of this works. So you mentioned that there's this buffering up above, there are these read and write system calls, which is how we access these devices, and we're going to talk about what these device drivers are doing. We already know they have their own buffers, but we don't know, like, how do they actually send things to the device? How do they receive things from the device? We're going to talk about that. First, I'm going to like remind us about the interface to access devices, which is the everything is a file. Everything is still a file. So our program is going to access using read, write, mmap, and so on. And we have so-called regular files, which are like files on disk. And we have these things called device files. And device files are like our keyboard is a file, but it's not a regular file. It doesn't act like a file on disk. You can't seek on it. You can't mmap the keyboard, probably. I could imagine it being possible, but probably you can't. So you're going to use this. It's a different type of file with a different implementation in the kernel, but these all eventually use device drivers that know how to talk to the actual devices. So they have this open, read, write, close interface, and the device driver inside the kernel to do this is going to implement basically an open function for this kind of device, keyboard open, keyboard read, and so on, you know, screen open, screen write. It's going to implement those functions in the kernel typically that just map to the system calls you make, open, read, write, close. And on a Unix-like system, there are files representing every kind of device you might imagine being connected. So for example, my Linux desktop, there's a file representing the audio playback device. So you can open that up, configure it, and write audio data to it, and it will play it. There's files representing the hard drives. Usually you use the file system, but you can open this file up, mmap it, or read and write it right to the disk directly. There's files representing the mouse and keyboard. You open them up and you read from them and you get mouse presses and key presses, so on. And there's a device to access the graphics card. It has DRI. You open it up and you can read, you know, mmap or read and write to show things on the screen. Okay. And these all the devices seem pretty straightforward in that you can imagine you open them and either you read from them or you write from them. You might have to figure out what's the format you read and write, but that seems straightforward. But sometimes that isn't good enough. And one thing is, like, let's think about the audio device. What format is this audio data in? If you know about audio formats, you might realize, well, PCM stands for pulse code modulated, but there's some parameters to that, like those rates at which the audio could be, and how do I set that? If we think about other devices, like if I have a DVD drive, I can eject the DVD drive. How do I do that? Do I write to the DVD drive? What's that operation look like? If I think about the terminal has an option to echo back what I'm typing or not. How do I set that option? Do I write something special to the terminal to do that? And we could like have some special things you write to the device to do this, but typically we've added extra operations for this. So in POSIX, there are some extra system calls that they suggest. One is IOCTL, which is for extra device operations like open the disk tray on my DVD drive. Things which don't make sense as a read or write. Or is there a disk in my DVD drive? Okay. So these are extra operations that just exist to handle those corner cases where open read-write doesn't make sense. And we'll pick up here next time.